Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Hi there, thanks for joining us on Sunday night on ABC Radio. Well, on May the 9th, 1960, 50 years ago this month, the United States Food and Drug Administration announced that a drug called Enovid 10 would be made available to women. That moment marks the beginning of one of the most significant social revolutions in human history. It's a revolution that continues. Enovid was a pill that could be taken orally by women and used to control ovulation. Enovid was the pill. Women were given control over their own bodies for the first time. No longer were they dependent on the male for effective contraception. No longer could employers excuse discrimination against qualified women on the basis that they would inevitably become pregnant and quit. The impact was even wider. The link between the sexual act and reproduction was severed. Tied for all of human history to issues of property and inheritance, women were finally free of any vestige of being a chattel or possession of their husband. More than this, sex, separated from reproduction, could be considered purely in terms of pleasure. In the decades following its introduction, the pill has been variously praised and blamed for instigating the sexual revolution and encouraging promiscuity among young women. Without the pill, we would not have had the 60s, feminism, and all that followed. The impact on ethics, morals, theology, and in particular congregational life in the churches of the West has been profound. Sex surrendered its secrets. The sacred veil was sundered. Centuries of teaching have had to be rethought, reworked, and rephrased. In 1968, the Catholic Church released its teaching on birth control called Humanae Vitae, and arguably broke centuries of allegiance to the Vatican and tradition as women defied the pronouncement in their millions. In such traditions as Islam, the impact is only beginning to be felt. Whichever way you look at it, there is not one corner of our way of life that does not continue to be shaped by the availability of the pill. Enovid 10 was its name, and it's not just about women or a certain generation. From religion to industrial relations, from feminism to family management, the impact of the pill resonates in every corner of modern life. Well, tonight on Sunday night, the impact of an invention that's touched every family in Australia. Were you a teenager in the 60s? At what point did you become aware of the pill? What was its impact on your life and that of your friends? What would your life be like without the pill? Give us a call on 1300 800 222 if you're in South Australia right now, and in the rest of Australia, I'll give you another shout in a few moments' time. Right now, it's my pleasure to introduce our studio guests who are just old enough to remember Life BP and AP. In Melbourne, well-known Anglican commentator and author, Dr. Muriel Porter. Muriel, welcome to you.
Good evening.
And in Sydney, Di Carmody, social worker and mother of five, and her husband, who we've met once or twice before here on Sunday nights, John Carmody, doctor and retired professor of physiology at the University of New South Wales. Welcome to you both.
Delighted to be here, John.
And you were both young Catholics caught up with university life in the 60s. We'll come to that sort of extraordinary period in just a few moments. But Muriel Porter, let me come to you first. I mentioned in the introduction to the program something of the social impact of the pill, yet I really felt I barely touched on just how thoroughgoing and profound the changes have been.
Well, they've been enormous. They didn't all happen, of course, in 1960. I think the pill didn't get to Australia till a year or so later. And then it took quite a while to filter through because it was quite controversial, John, in terms of health areas. It's still a bit controversial, as you know, the levels of hormonal treatment going into women's bodies. But particularly then, they were pretty high dose. And, of course, who it could be prescribed for and who could and with what permission. So it took a while to really begin to impact on people's lives. But once it really took effect, I think it's been the catalyst for enormous change. But it didn't come out of nowhere. Contraception was a reality before that, much clumsier and less attractive methods. And also, of course, there was a first wave feminism revolution. Women were being educated. Women were slowly coming into the workforce. So the demand for the pill was created by those pressures for population control among couples and also by women wanting to have careers as well as to have married life.
So the demand was there, and this in some ways was a response to a pre-existing demand.
Yes.
Yet nevertheless, people probably didn't quite anticipate the impact that it would have. I mean, the demand was seen in a very immediate and personal sense, yet the impact has been profound. I mean, even in your own writings, as somebody who's been active in writing on the church over the years, the impact of the pill and through that into feminism has been quite significant.
It certainly has, but I don't think most church leaders or theologians have even today really understood that. I don't think the impact and the changes it's made to the whole way we view personal sexual morality. My sense is that most theologians writing in this area, unless they're really women perhaps, and got a sort of feminist perspective, tend still to treat it as something that has to be controlled, the pill itself has to be controlled, or contraception, still keeping up the old rules. What I think the pill did was to say the old rules had huge value because they protected vulnerable women and children. Now the rules can be changed because women and children aren't so vulnerable.
And, of course, that also splits another link. That is, the link between once you separate sex from procreation, you introduce the possibility of sex being seen as something just for pleasure.
Indeed. And, in fact, that's been the big change in a very subtle way, even in the Anglican marriage service, for instance. And not a lot of people are even aware of that, how subtle that change has been.
What, does it change the wording?
Changed the purposes of matrimony, as it was put in the 1662 prayer book dating back to Cranmer in the 16th century, right up to more modern translations, always had the threefold causes of marriage. And the first was always procreation, for the, you know, the procreation of children. The second was right ordering of the sexual instinct, or as Cranmer put it, so that we didn't behave like brute beasts. And the third was the companionship, mutual comfort, society and support that the one ought to have of the other. But by the time we get to the more modern prayer books in the Anglican Church, the modern forms of marriage, they are quite different in the way they write about it. In fact, I've got it here in front of me. It says that Scripture teaches that marriage is a lifelong partnership uniting a woman and a man in heart, mind and body. In the joy of their union, husband and wife enrich and respond to each other, growing in tenderness and understanding. So that's the first cause, if you like. Through marriage, a new family is formed where children may be born and grow in secure and loving care. So we have the relationship, the interrelationship of the man and woman is the prior cause of marriage.
That's a quite remarkable change from
what had existed
previously. John and Di Carmody, let me bring you in here. Di Carmody, you're a mother of five, you're a social worker, you've seen the issue from both sides. You're somebody who, as a young Catholic woman, would have experienced the impact of the social revolution of the pill, particularly the impact it had on Catholic consciousness leading up to 1968, when the Pope came to terms with it all and issued an encyclical called Humanae Vitae, which rather than liberating and embracing new technology, basically said, no, we're going to stop it right here and now. Stop it.
Just when we all thought that it would change and he would have the sense to realise the importance of choice in terms of having children, and to be so blind, I think, as to think that you just abstain and have rhythm method and you can't actually stop and think with your partner in the love. I love those words in the English prayer book. They are just beautiful.
The Australian prayer book.
The Australian Anglican prayer book, my apologies. But they are such beautiful words, and that really is what marriage should all be about.
What was it like for you at the time, just going through that? Like in the lead-up to Humanae Vitae, after the impact of the pill comes through, what were young people talking about?
Well, to begin with, I think my friends and I've taken a bit of a a vote on this. We really thought in the 60s, at the very beginning, well, we do what the church says, because we weren't all that interested. We were very good Catholic girls, busy at the university, and we didn't actually worry very much about procreation or contraception or anything like that. However, by the time I was married, which was prior, of course, to Humanae Vitae, and before we had our first child, I was certainly quite happy to go by my own conscience and take the pill, because I felt it was very important to decide together when it was the right time to have our first child. Didn't do quite so well with the next two, because I was breastfeeding when I became pregnant with the next two. So
it's not supposed to happen.
It's not supposed to happen. I ended up with three under three, and then thought, right, again, I'll go back on the pill, which makes all the difference when you're actually able to plan what is the best thing to do for yourself, your partner, your family, and not to have this have to have children whether you want to or not, which is what, when you read about the past, is what was expected, that wives would do their marital duty and would just go on having children whether they wanted to or not. They'd have to be there for their partners when their partner wanted them to be, and they couldn't really abstain. If they didn't want to abstain, they would be told in confession, you must do what your husband wants. And that is just not what a loving partnership and marriage is all about.
Did you have any crisis of conscience when Humanae Vitae was announced, when the church said that the pill and other forms of artificial contraception are really strictly embargoed?
Not at all. By then, I was totally confident in my own conscience and that I was doing the right thing. I was also had worked as a social worker for a few years before we got married. I was very aware of the impact of unwanted pregnancies on very young people who hadn't been able to prevent this happening. I'm also devastated at the numbers of terminations that were done as a form of contraception, because contraception wasn't approved of. So by the time that encyclical came out, I just thought that was very sad and a very bad decision to be made. And I don't think any of my friends either, really, or many of my friends would have been very impacted on it either and had a crisis of conscience, I'm afraid to say. We believe we're right ourselves.
John Carmody, you're somebody who, as well as being a physiologist, also a keen Catholic layperson. You've participated in the theological discussions going through the Catholic Church over the years. How significant do you think, in terms of a breach, a fundamental breach between the faithful and the Church, was Humanae Vitae?
I think it's absolutely fundamental and crucial to what's happened to church attendance, particularly in Catholicism, because it was renowned for having a very high correlation between those who are declared Catholics and those who actually practice it regularly. Muriel made a very important point, I think, about contemporary conditions being the bed in which this plant was growing.
Yes, because young Catholics weren't inured from the social forces around them.
Well, it goes back, I think, on two grounds, to World War II, which I think had a profound influence in all sorts of ways that are not recognised on this community. And it was during World War II that American scientific pharmacology had a tremendous fillip, helped by the discovery of penicillin and the British passing the secrets over to the Americans. And that's really the foundation of a prosperous American pharmacological industry, which could afford all the field trials and so on, which Rock and Pincus and co. did in Cuba and elsewhere. That's the first point. And the second point, of course, was that women went into the workforce in large numbers during World War II. They had to come back out of the workforce, and there was a lot of resentment about that. So we had both of those strands converging. And Muriel's right, the pill didn't come to Australia in 1960 immediately, but I was very aware of it as a medical student in my last years, and trying to understand these things scientifically. I remember all sorts of priests turning themselves into knots in public seminars and fora and so on, trying to rationalise their clear belief that it was morally licit, but not appearing to be contrary to what the Vatican was saying. And then everyone was expecting In 1967, the Tablet and others published details of leaks by the Special Commission. John the 23rd had set it up, and then Paul the 6th inherited it, added a few married people, interestingly, to it. It's widely believed that it recommended that the pill be legitimised, as it were, and Paul the 6th came out and no doubt got out by the Curia or by a concern for papal power, which had gone back a long way. I mean, things like the doctrine of the Assumption, the canonization of Maria Goretti. I see all of these as the church reaction to
the modern world, really.
Well, that the Americans at the end of the war had landed at Anzio and Italy was never going to be the same again because all these sexy, handsome Americans giving the girls nylons and all the rest of it, and the priests were more terrified than the mothers were, I think. So, I mean, that was a profound social change which hit Italy and could not be avoided by the Vatican. So, but there was a lot of nonsense talked about hair-splitting to say, oh, we mustn't interfere with anything natural. Well, priests had been interfering with things that were natural, and we all of us had.
The very definition of medicine in some ways is an interference with what's natural.
You've taken the words right out of my mouth, John. I don't know a single priest who would have thought that it was immorally wrong to take tablets for his blood pressure or if he got pneumonia to take penicillin, and these are no less interfering. And I used to say this to priests at the time and they'd blanch at the very thought and go back into their bolt holes. So all that was interference with the natural law, because if you got pneumonia, you normally died. But that didn't worry them. It was about interfering with the sexual law. And, of course, we had celibate males for whom this was a major issue.
Two points I'd like to take up before we begin to take calls on this, while we're talking about the history of this thing. Muriel, just coming back to you for a moment and picking up the point about context that you began with and John and I picked up. The context after the First World War, the Anglican Church had got a whiff that things were needing to change on this front. It seems a fair while before anyone else. You alluded to the way the marriage rite changed, but there were also changes in the 20s and 30s at the way the Anglicans were dealing with matters of sexuality generally.
Yes, there was. This deserves more exploration as to exactly what was propelling this, I think. But the Lambeth Conference, that's the international meeting of bishops every 10 years in the Anglican Communion, in 1908 and then again in 1920, it had condemned all forms of artificial contraception. But in 1930, it gave a very, very cautious approval for married couples where there were morally sound reasons for avoiding complete abstinence. Not quite sure what they thought that meant, but they were being very cautious with married couples. And I think this was because there were, even then, after the First World War, more women, more educated women, women in the workforce and so forth, in an industrial society where you don't want as many children to work the land as an agrarian population would have. So there were already these pressures and they were trying to catch up. Then in 1958, there was the extraordinary breakthrough, and I always think it's interesting that it was a whole decade before Humana Vitae, and of course, 2 years before Ovid was invented. They actually had an extraordinary decision by the Lambeth Conference, in which, while they still supported contraception only for married people, they actually saw the sexual relationship between the husband and wife as being preeminently of importance for the husband and wife, regardless of it being procreative. And that, in my view, was an absolute breakthrough for any group of church fathers in the whole history of Christianity.
Yes, because it gave them a path. It pointed them in a direction which enabled them to avoid the problems that the Catholic Church later
faced. That's right. And it was quite frank and quite open that the sexual relationship, that this was the sexual intercourse, they said, was not the only means, the only language of earthly love, but it was, in its full and right use, the most intimate and most revealing. And they said it had the depth of communication signified by the biblical word so often used for it, knowledge. And that this relationship between the husband and wife, sexual relationship, was of the highest value in and of itself. quite Muriel, apart from whether procreation was involved.
Muriel, what arguments were advanced to support that remarkable view? Because I suspect it revealed that some of the bishops at Lambeth and their advisers must have been much better informed about human evolution, so that sexuality was much more than just reproduction, because the nature of reproduction in our species is radically different behaviourally and physiologically from other species. What sorts of arguments did they advance? I mean, did they think about have a sophisticated view of evolution of human sexuality, for example?
Well, I haven't seen that, but there are two things. Of course, they were married men.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say that's very relevant.
They're married men. There were some, of course, who would have been single, but the vast majority of them were married men who actually had practice in this area, mm-hmm. in the home, mm-hmm. and the whole familial relationship. So that's number one. But number two, don't forget there was a huge concern at the time about population pressure. We think that this concern for the fragility of the environment is a fairly new phenomenon, but it really wasn't. Back in the 50s, there was a huge concern about the world exploding with population growth. And this is one of the arguments that was most important to them. Mm-hmm. I don't think they had the fully fledged understanding. Perhaps some who advised them did, but I haven't seen that in mm-hmm. the written record. Mm-hmm. It may well be there for someone to do a PhD on it mm-hmm. sometime. Be interesting to know.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. John Cleary with you. We're talking about the pill. May this year marks 50 years since the introduction of the contraceptive pill. If you'd like to have a chat about the impact it's had on your life, your family, your views on the world, your views on religion and the church. Well, just before we take calls, there's one other area of this I'd like to explore, and perhaps Di, I might come to you first, although feel free, any of you, to comment on this. Prior to the radical changes in contraception and attitudes to it, women's fertility and fecundity had always inevitably been linked to two things, inheritance and property. And here is another link thousands of years, as deep into human history as you can go, that's profoundly broken. But still, in a sense, because the Humanae Vitae didn't change Catholic attitudes to it, do you think that's affected other attitudes in Catholicism about women and about the way women are seen and treated? Is there a link, do you think? Is there a common thread here?
I think there could well be a common thread. But to me, the common thread is that they don't have the ability to think beyond inheritance and property, which I think is also was one of the things to do with celibacy for priests, that they couldn't have families and therefore disperse the property of the church. I mean, this is just not the way to be looking at relationships and pastoral care. And it's beautiful listening to what Muriel said about the Lambeth Council. Makes me feel like changing religion almost immediately.
We've had a few problems, Di.
Yes, we'll talk about those in a moment. There is something deeply cultural, though, here, Jack, isn't there? Going back into, deep Mediterranean tradition. I mean, the family has been anything, and control of the female was essential to the nature of maintaining society. It was essential to the nature of civilization.
It was indeed, and another thread of this has been the enduring hostility of Catholicism, controlled from the southern Mediterranean, as you put quite rightly say, deep antipathy towards modern science. I date the birth of modern science, medical science and physical science, to 1543, when in the same year Andreas Vesalius published his great textbook on anatomy, which immediately made anatomy a modern subject and built the foundations for modern medicine. 100 years later, it was William Harvey. But in the same year, 1543, Nicholas Copernicus published his book on the movement of the heavenly bodies, well before Galileo Galilei. This was not only in the same year, which is quite astonishing, and the beginning of the modern physical and biological sciences, but it was also in the ferment of the Counter-Reformation, and it was right at the time of the Council of Trent. And the Counter-Reformation was opposed to all change, and science got caught up in that. So in many ways south of the Alps has remained scientifically behind Northern Europe and Britain, scientifically, and the Vatican was part of that digging your heels in against anything scientific. And part of the hostility was if a regime in the church refuses to accept the legitimacy of, let alone inform itself about, modern scientific developments, then you're going to have these sorts of problems. So it's all tied up with that.
Muriel, this goes something towards the issues you've dealt with in the present Anglican Church, that attitudes to women are still deeply tied to almost pre-Christian attitudes to property and other things.
Well, there is still that hankering to control women. And parts of the Anglican Church, like my good friends in the Diocese of Sydney, which insist that women are equal but different. they can be judges and parliamentarians and governors general and sovereigns, but in the home and in the church, only a man can be an authority. And I see that as a fallback to that the very ancient view that women have to be controlled, and I think that's where the pill in particular has cut through, because women's sexuality, women and their careers and everything else is completely severed from that male control, so that a woman can still have be a sexual being but be completely financially independent with a career and a job and all the rest of it, and enjoying herself if that is her wont, quite apart from marriage and family life. So that is almost the preeminent fear of primitive male species, to have women who actually have control of their own bodies and their own financial freedom.
And
I think that threatens all the churches in all sorts of subtle ways still today.
Even within partnerships, women can be in control of whether or not they have a child. I mean, their partner isn't going to know whether stop taking the pill or whether they start taking the pill. For the first time ever, they have got the control.
Does it flow also, Muriel, into subsequent discussions of sexuality that even play out into the debate going on about homosexuality?
Oh, I think it does, because I think that little piece I read you a moment ago from that 1958 Lambeth Conference, when they made the point that sexual relationship is the prior order to procreation, that was severing sexual relationships from procreation, and therefore legitimised sexual pleasure, if you like, among married couples firstly, but then heterosexual couples, and lo and behold, homosexual people as well. I can remember being quite bowled over when a very thoughtful gay man in the church said that to me. You do realise that the pill also gave freedom to homosexual people to have sexual freedom, because sexual pleasure of and of itself became acceptable at certain levels. Well, I think that's part of the great discussion that's going on about homosexuality in my own church.
A great deal of the so-called morality, let's put it in inverted commas, that was age-old, and taking your point about property, John, was the concern for legitimacy, wasn't it? And all the scandal and taboos and so on were as much about women as chattels. Give an unsullied product to the young husband. He could sow his wild oats, of course. He was sexually free, but she wasn't. But also, if there were an illegitimate child, that put tensions on the family in all sorts of ways, not least issues of inheritance and so on. So that what the advent of the pill did was to force people to confront the fundamental philosophical and moral basis of a lot of these things, which were nothing more than pragmatic social practice, which had been elevated to having some sort of superior
sacred status.
Mm. And once, as you say, Muriel, once that nexus between sexual relationships, not that it was always there, because after all, females in the human species are only fertile for a very short period of the month, a great deal, most sexual activity will not be capable, and the priests didn't have the biological knowledge to have the slightest grasp of this, will be dissociated from reproduction. But the pill made it the possibility for it to be absolute. And that was such a threat that suddenly people had to confront the basis for their moral tenets, and they didn't know how to deal with it.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. Our guests, Dr. John Carmody, Di Carmody, and Muriel Porter. Muriel Porter, well-known author and commentator on Anglican affairs. Di Carmody, wife of John, mother of five and social worker. And Dr. John Carmody, retired professor of physiology from the University of New South Wales. And you on ABC Radio Around Australia, via Radio Australia, and through the web to the world. Let's say hi to Mary in Queensland. Hello, Mary. What is it you'd like to say?
Oh, hi, John. I'd just like to make a comment from my own personal experience. I just think that I hear a lot of generalisations being spoken tonight, and I'm not a theologian, but I've been married 34 years, and my husband and I, he's not a Catholic, I am, made a decision that we were not going to go on the pill, because we didn't take any other chemical into our body, into my body, and why would I start taking a chemical into my body? And, you know, as I was saying a few minutes ago, it's only a small time in the cycle when you actually could become pregnant. So you're taking this chemical all this month, and they only need it for, you know, a short period. So we chose not to do it, but I don't take all the time. But also, we have children now in their late 20s, two daughters and a daughter-in-law, and one of our daughters studied science for 4 years and chiropractic for five, and she would never take the pill for her own body's sake. And a lot of their friends are saying to her that the side effects of the pill is actually, it squashes their libido, it changes their personality, and they won't touch it. So I think for a lot of women, it may be a solution, and I respect that, but I just feel that the generalisation coming through in this talk is that it's good for all people, and I think that a lot of them don't want it. It affects their relationship. So that's only my thought.
Mary, thanks for that. Di Carmody, do you want to respond to Mary?
Well, I think that part of what we've been talking about is the all sorts of contraception as well, because I think from the church's point of view, we weren't meant to indulge in any contraception. We were meant to be a subject to our masters, Lord and Masters, and there for procreation only. Yes, of course, for some people, it is very concerning to take any chemicals into their body. As I said, I took a vote from some of my friends, and one of my friends said she never would have taken it because she doesn't take any sort of medication under any circumstances. But there are certainly opportunities to use other forms of contraception as well, like the rhythm method, which worked for many people, not for everybody though.
Natural family planning is a bit more advanced than the rhythm method too.
Absolutely, yes, but we're talking back about the 60s and the 70s.
Well, 76 I was married, and it was a very, very effective, scientifically designed program at that time.
Yes, well, I accept that, and you did well. Congratulations on that. But my children are also not taking it, I think, mostly, but they know that there is that opportunity for choice. And my concern has always been when an unwanted child comes along, maybe to a married, maybe to an unmarried person, it can make a great deal of difference to that child's life and the ability for a family to relate to each other.
Mary, thanks for your call. We're going to have to move on. A few calls on the board. 1300 800 222, if you'd like to give us a call. One thing we should mention, in passing, we mentioned there the rhythm method, and we should say that the rhythm method as practiced these days was very importantly developed by an Australian couple, Dr. John Billings, and he became a bit of a celebrity in Catholic circles internationally for some years. I think a papal knighthood flowed his way. Is that correct?
I'm not sure, but I wouldn't be surprised. I tend to call it the dysrhythm method because it works much, much better for some people than for others. People had to recognise that and still have to recognise that. Cycles vary, and that if they're going to practice that method, they must be prepared for consequences. But the issue of choice is very important. I mean,
it's important to honour Mary's choice.
Absolutely,
isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes. And in the very early days, that choice was even stronger because the dosages of the early contraceptive pills were much higher than they are now. Combinations of medications are different, and that's partly because people didn't want to market a medication which had a a particular claim for it, that is, it was going to preclude conception, and then face the consequences that there were unwanted pregnancies because the dosage in our early years of knowledge of it were too low. So the doses were kept higher than really necessary, and there were complications, no question about that.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. We're talking about the pill on its 50th anniversary. 1-300-800-222 if you'd like to take part in the conversation. Saying hi to Ewan in Dandenong now. Hello, Ewan, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Welcome to it also.
I believe you're a gynecologist.
Oh, yes.
What would you like to say?
Well, I was practicing human relations mainly and contraceptive practice in a very busy practice. And I think that, well, as Muriel Porter said a few minutes ago, the pill has released women from their subjugation and made them much more free. And I found that they... with the big thing that worries me is everybody's worried about the side effects of the pill. And I liken the pill to have exactly the same chemical nature as that of a woman's pregnant woman, and which is surely the best contraception at all. And therefore, if the side effects, so-called, are just the same thing as those of a pregnant woman, which are nothing to worry about at all.
John Carmody, perhaps you can comment on that too, the physiology of the pill, its physiological impact.
Well, they're of a class of chemicals that are called steroids, and no drug is pure in its effects. Drugs that are taken for asthma have effects on the heart and so on, and so they do have some effects on water metabolism, and women can get swollen feet and a whole range of things like that. But these days, because the doses are so much lower than they were, the side effects are much, much lower. People were worried about the potential side effects of cancer induction as well.
Yes.
And with lower doses, that's far less of a problem.
Yes.
But I would go even further than Ewan and say, as Di was saying, if there is an unwanted child, whether in a marriage or out of a relationship or out of an enduring relationship, then the side effects of that to the family and the child are much more enduring than any side effects of taking the drug.
Oh, heaven, yes. Yes. Also, I think that the pill has released women from their so-called bondage before, where they had virtually unreliable and messy sort of contraception, and therefore they have become much more assertive. And the one thing I have noticed, and I don't know whether the panel would be interested in this observation, is that the decline in interest and membership of churches it seems to have dated from when the pill started to come in. Prior to that, one of the biggest influences on the pill was fear of the family and fear of the church as far as getting pregnant.
You're absolutely right, Ewan. And when you say release from bondage to the priests as well.
Yes, well, I won't go into that.
Ewan, thanks for your call. We'll get some comment on that. We'll have to move on. Muriel, perhaps first you and then Di on Ewan's last point.
Well, I think certainly there is that coincidence that women have ceased going to church by and large at that same time, but I think that's because the churches simply couldn't cope with it. They couldn't cope with women who were freed. And there is a whole generation of women. I'm a sort of a rare survivor, really, in my age group. Most of the women of my age group actually left because the church was on about things that had nothing to do with their modern lives and in fact rejected a full equal role for women in the church in the same way that women were now experiencing it in the community. We've got there finally in the Anglican Church, most of us, but sort of 20, 30 years too late for so many of those women who've left.
Die.
Well, yes, I'd agree with you, Muriel, although in my experience, when I do go to church, a lot more of the churchgoers are women than men.
Oh, yes.
We tend to go to priests who we know will speak some sense and not go to eschew the parish where we feel that we'll get this, the priest who is not really related to women's issues.
But do you think it? Do you think it cost the church a generation of women of a certain sort? That is a certain thinking sort.
Of the thinking sort. Yes, I do. And that generation of women are out there still, presumably with their own spirituality, going by their own consciences and leading extremely moral lives without the benefit of the irrelevancy of going to church.
While we're on this, and just before we take some more calls, don't go away, folks, touching the impact on Christianity and the way it's unfolded in the West, other religious traditions are yet to really feel the impact, and I'm thinking particularly of Islam as it confronts the West. And Muriel, you must be looking at some of the discussions and debates that are happening in Islam and think, my goodness, there's a train coming down the track here.
I think so, yes. I'm no expert on it, and I wouldn't want to comment too much, but even the debates about women's dress, the burqa and so forth, I think this is tinkering at the edges of things that are very complex, and we really, there is a train coming for them as they, in particular, in some particular Islamic societies, as they move out of the sort of culture that our society moved out of a century or so ago, in terms of an agrarian culture or a culture where many sons are needed to till the land, that sort of thinking. Once you move out of that sort of situation, then the demands of modern life really do come up very close.
Mm. Di, did you want to observe?
No, just to say that I would agree with Muriel there, and I feel that there is quite a degree of bondage, as far as I can see from my social work practice, amongst many Muslim women who are very much there to produce lots of children and to just do the best that they possibly can, staying at home.
Let's go to Louise in Tasmania. Hello, Louise. Welcome. What would you like to say?
Oh, hello, John. Yes. Look, I've been listening now for a few minutes, and I'm quite, you know, I disagree with everything that your guests have said. One thing I'd like to pick up on is they were talking a few minutes ago about the so-called rhythm method. Now, why do we keep hearing that this is the only method for natural family planning? The fact is that John Billings and his wife, they went deeply into the science behind it, and we have natural family planning where women observe fertile and non-fertile symptoms. It's not based on the length of their cycle. That's what the rhythm method was. The methods that are used today, the symptothermo and other ones like that, natural family planning, are based on observing fertile and non-fertile symptoms, and they're very effective. Many women use them. It means they don't have to take these drugs that affect their bodies, that lead to all sorts of things that obviously the pharmaceutical companies don't want us to know about. That's just one point. And the other thing I'd like to say is the pill has been a disaster for women. It's led to less respect for them from men. They're sexually available. They're seeing sexual objects. It's led to breakdown of marriage. Women who desperately want children, their husbands can say, well, no, I want you to stay on the pill. And, you know, if they don't want them, that's it. The Humanae Vitae, you mentioned that, I haven't heard much, you might have talked about it a little bit earlier. I'd just like to say that I'd like to ask you guys if they've actually read Humanae Vitae. It is a beautiful vision, God's vision for sexuality, and it is a beautiful one. And everything that's been said tonight, I really believe, misleads people about what the intent of that document was, what the church says. The church is teaching what the God's plan for sexuality, which is a beautiful one, where loving couples, a man and a woman, married, welcome children.
Louise, thanks for that. We'll get a comment from Di Carmody. Di.
Well, I would agree that loving couples in marriage welcome children. I've had an experience with my lovely aunt who had 7 children. With her last child, she very, very nearly died, and she was begged to use some form of contraception. This was before the pill, but she lost the child, and not very long afterwards she died. And I think Jack, his grandmother died in childbirth. Those are some of the implications that came from not being able to have some other more effective forms of contraception, but it can still work naturally. I know that.
What about the point Louise made about attitudes changing among women themselves and about men's attitudes to women?
Well, I don't agree that necessarily men's attitudes to women have changed, because I think they did sow their wild oats anyway. Maybe they would sometimes now say to the young, well, you can protect yourself. But to me, it's very much a man's responsibility, and it's a woman's responsibility to decide what she wants to do about her own body and to make her own choices.
Yeah, Muriel, there was a very common feeling in the church, and I think it's still there in churches, that part of the, and it goes back to this question of the authority and control that the church exerts through moral injunctions, that somehow sexuality was linked to sin, and sinful behaviour was immoral behaviour, or sexual behaviour was immoral behaviour, and therefore sinful, and therefore worthy of condemnation. It would keep you out of heaven.
Yes, and I think that is the case, that we've jumped to conclusions down the centuries too easily. And I often think that some of the earlier rules, before there was effective means of contraception and so forth, the rule about not having sex without marriage, etc., was a very sound one. If the alternative was a child who'd be abandoned, an unwanted child, a woman being vulnerable and being misused. Those rules had purpose when there was not really any choice about the matter. But I would also think that it's too easy to say that there is one God's plan for sexuality. It actually, in the Bible, is not written out in that way at all. Respect for each other certainly is, but I don't see any blueprint in the Bible. People talk about the blueprint, Adam and Eve and so forth, and then we see all the rest of them in the Old Testament with their multiple wives. I think there's Adam and Eve, and I think it's only Isaac and Rebecca are the only two monogamous couples in the whole Old Testament. So it's very hard to find that sort of God's blueprint there in the Bible. And of course we get to the New Testament, where Jesus actually said, who are my mother and sisters and brothers, those who do the will of God, and actually said that family life was secondary to the sort of community that he was creating. So it's very hard to find that God's plan clearly written in the Bible anywhere.
Do you think, and we've got to wind the conversation up in 3 or 4 minutes, so I'll just ask you generally this. Let's talk about the impact now on young people, and this, particularly young people with regard to the church and sexual mores within the church. Do you think there is a sort of a don't ask, don't tell goes on, that young people generally are living one sort of life with one set of standards of sexual morality, which have been worked out in practice, a sort of code that's observed, and that this bears very little relationship to the formal code still enunciated by the church? Muriel first.
Oh, I would agree with that, absolutely. I think most young people, the young people I used to teach at RMIT University here, my own family and others I know, young people actually have a very high view of sexual morality. It's not the same code that we had pre-1960, that code that no sex until you're married, but they are very, very strong on their rules and regulations within their own code that I think is as moral as anything we had, and much more real and much more open. But the church pretends that isn't happening, and so continues to lose these young people.
And that code is shaped by women as much as it is by men.
Among the young people, yes, certainly. But also for gay people, the great tragedy is that the church is don't tell us anything we don't want to know, because they're too frightened of it. And that condemns so many good gay Christians either to lives of secrecy or to lives of deep, deep loneliness.
Yeah. John Carmody, your observation of young people in university life these days.
Well, I didn't discuss these things all that often, teaching them physiology, but I would simply say that, as I mentioned earlier, when you look around most Catholic churches that I've been in the last few years, most of the congregation are quite old. There's some young people, but they're mostly children. There are very few in the, say, 20 to 40 age group. most of them were women, and so they voted with their feet, and they're making their own decisions. And I'm sure that Muriel is absolutely correct. There's no reason for us arrogantly to believe that our generation had the keys to morality and the prisons don't.
Dag, you're given the last 10 seconds.
Well, I do agree with that, and I do think that the younger generation are extremely moral, and I think that they are very aware of the impact of terminations, and they would rather use contraception than risk that.
Thanks for your participation in the discussion, and from you at home as well. Thanks to Di and John Carmody and to Muriel Porter for joining us here in the discussion on Sunday night. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.